Do not store files. Okay, very good. Technical stuff. Okay, well, I'm going to get started even though that's doing its little thing. There we go. Hesperian developed a community guide to environmental health in conjunction with hundreds of community-based organizations internationally and within the U.S. All of them are communities, all of them are communities experiencing significant barriers to health, from war and civil unrest to floods, droughts, and conflict over needs and use of the available environmental resources. A topics list and environmental health education and how-to activities were drafted and sent to communities for field testing and review. Our framework for this book, as for all Hesperian books, is one of human rights, empowerment, and harm reduction. We believe that we start from wherever people are at and build community capacity one step at a time to improve health and to work for environmental justice. I want to just start with some basic definitions. Human rights, I think we all know the very legal definitions probably, and we just want to take it down a little bit of a notch and just say to us and the people that we've worked with internationally, human rights are basic rights that we all have simply because we are human. And regardless of who we are, where we live, or what we do, human rights present all the things that are important to us as human beings, such as being able to choose how to live our lives and being treated with dignity and respect. The guide uses a slightly broader definition of environmental health than is perhaps commonly used in the public health world. Environmental health, according to the community guide, simply means the way that our health is affected by the world around us and how our activities affect the health of our environments. If our food, water, and air are contaminated, they'll make us sick. If we're not careful about how we use the air, water, and land, we can make ourselves and the world around us sick. By protecting our environment, we protect our health. Conservationists may look at the needs of the environment first, and public health practitioners and primary health care workers might address direct health impacts on people, such as cholera or tuberculosis. The guide attempts to integrate these approaches. So a Save the Forest campaign that does not take into account that the trees might be competing for water and land that is sorely needed to produce food for the surrounding communities may not be successful. And health practitioners, in our experience of working with communities around the world, cannot readily address the problem of cholera without also addressing access to safe, clean water and sanitation and sustainable management of watershed and forests, amongst other environmental resources. And to us, people are the most important and precious environmental resource. Environmental health is always a community issue and requires people working together to make improvements, whether the goal is to reduce the risk of an epidemic, to plant a community garden, to improve health and safety of people living near a factory or working in a mine, or to address some other environmental health issue. The more people have a shared understanding of the problem and a shared commitment to solving it, the more successful they will be. I stopped on this slide because this is one framework for an approach and a view of what is causing the environmental crisis that, in fact, we are all facing. I don't care what community we live in, anywhere in the world, we are all collectively facing a community, an environmental health crisis. And it is also hugely an environmental injustice to all. So the framework that we use in this book is one that actually we learned from communities that we were working with, and particularly from Dr. Mira Shiva, who works in India, and she presented us with a framework that is called scarcity and excess. And it's really easy. It's a scarcity of the essential things we need for a healthy life, such as clean air, water, healthy soil and forest, safe and comfortable shelter, and safe working conditions, and an excess of things that we really do not need, such as trash, toxic chemicals, pollution, and junk food. And I'm sure we're going to hear a lot about that from our other panelists today. So what we do know is that there's a difference of opinion about where the scarcity and excess come from. The opinion of the hundreds of communities we've worked with and of Hesperian is that a rich man's explanation of poverty and environmental destruction might be too many people and too few resources, and we know that this is a very popular opinion, but our opinion is actually one that sides with the majority of people of the world that says it's an unfair distribution of land and resources, and there is too much in the hands of too few. So let's take a moment and think about this. Too many people, too few resources. The amount of water, trees, minerals, and other natural resources on Earth is indeed limited, and the number of people using these resources is indeed growing. We're not disputing that. But we do say that the number of people is not the real problem. To us, the real problem is how these natural resources are distributed and used. Anytime one person or nation or a group of people or nations uses more than their fair share of the resources or causes an excess of pollution, this imbalance can lead to an environmental health problem and environmental injustice. Some people believe the best way to prevent harm to our environment is to reduce the number of people, and this way of thinking leads to population control programs. We all know about these. Anybody who works in public health knows about population control, whether it's in the U.S. or anywhere else in the world. These programs, though, if you look at the data, have consistently failed to improve the lives of the people because they do not address the root causes of environmental destruction, poverty, and poor health. Programs that try to meet these needs, more fundamental needs, and present families with the resources they need to live with health and dignity. When families have these options, many choose to have fewer children. We believe that only when communities, governments, and development programs plan for the survival of children and the improvement of the social, political, and economic status of women will the so-called population problem be solved. By reducing the number of people in the world does not address the problem of unequal use of resources. The best way to reduce the harmful effects that people have on the environment is for the rich and more empowered nations to use fewer resources and to use them in ways that conserve resources for the future and do not create an excess of pollution. By first changing the behavior of those who use the most, we can begin to make sure that there will be enough for a healthy life for everyone. When people's daily needs are met, they are better able to think about the future, including how to care for the environment. So, for example, people who live in and care for forests know that there are many ways to earn a living from the forest without causing too much damage. But in many cases, deforestation is caused by the demands of industry and the pressures of poverty. I want to share two stories from communities that participated in developing the community guide that helped to illustrate some of the principles that framed our work. And that's what all of these photos have been, has been pictures that people who have been testing the guide and doing the work in their own communities around the world have sent us. So the first story I'm going to share is about how different communities handle solid waste, and I'm going to look at two communities we worked with on different parts of the world. One was in Buenos Aires, Argentina, and the group was El Alamo, and they are a cooperative of waste collectors in Buenos Aires that were founded to protect community environmental health and to organize for workers' rights. When the municipal government in Buenos Aires initiated a local waste collection, they did not plan to give jobs to all of the people who had been collecting waste as part of the informal network of workers, of waste collectors in the city. And they had been doing this waste collection and recycling to support their families for many, many years. So El Alamo organized to defend the rights of the traditional waste collectors and to make the community waste and resource recovery program one of the most comprehensive in the world. El Alamo started by organizing a community survey and was able to show the municipal government that if all the waste paper in the city was collected and recycled, it would save $10 million U.S. a year, and if this money was used to pay all of the waste collectors in the city, each person would earn over 150 US dollars per month. The government was convinced to incorporate traditional waste collectors into the new system, and we're happy to say that today all of the traditional waste collectors are in fact still employed by the city of Buenos Aires. Another example is in the Philippines. The work of two organizations who are important partners to Hesperian in developing this guide, the Global Anti-Incineration Alliance, which operates worldwide, and Healthcare Without Harm. They helped to mobilize a nation, the nation of the Philippines, to pass a national law to stop waste incineration. For many years, waste in the Philippines was piled up in open dumps or was burned. As pollution got worse, many communities began to pressure the government to ban waste burning and to stop the open dumping. The campaign began in 1985 with an education program. Activists traveled all over the country teaching communities about better ways to prevent waste from being created and then how to reduce, separate, compost, reuse, and recycle the waste that they had. They invited people from all walks of life, from peasants to politicians to priests, to work together to reduce waste in the communities, and they were successful. In 1999, a new law was passed called the Clean Air Act in the Philippines, and 1 year later, the government began a national recycling program and passed a law to turn all of the open dumps into sanitary landfills. Finally, in 2001, the government passed the Ecological Waste Management Act to establish resource recovery centers. The second example I want to use is from India. We sent out drafts of our watershed and forestry chapters to a number of communities to be tested, and one of the main fundamental guiding principles was save the trees, the forest, and plant trees everywhere. So we learned a lot from the work of the communities that were reviewing our chapters, because one of the things that we found was that communities were experiencing a tremendous amount of conflict over how to best use their forestry resources. And that what was really important to them was to train the community in conflict resolution principles so that they could figure out how to reach a resolution. When trees were competing for land that was needed for crops and water, they learned how to apportion so that they could dedicate some land for crops. In other places, what they needed was to harvest resources from the forest, but not over harvest. And in another community, they were dealing with the municipal government trying to come in with trucks and chainsaws where they were used to using oxen and hand saws. And so, again, the community resolution, conflict resolution, is what really taught us how to rearrange our understanding of environmental justice in the use of watershed and forestry resources. I'm just going to end by talking about that only a human rights approach is going to ensure environmental health and justice for all. Because everyone uses natural resources, we all have some part to play in protecting, preserving, and sharing these resources. We can talk about conserving natural resources all day long, but so long as inequality continues, environmental health will be a right only for those who have wealth and power, and not for the many who need these resources for daily use and survival. As the great Indian leader Mahatma Gandhi said, there is enough for everyone's need, but not enough for everyone's greed. And that is the end of my talk. Okay. Thank you. So our next speaker